Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books and Gender Studies. I'm a co-host on the channel, Lillian Barger. Today my conversation is with Erin M. Kimker, Associate Professor of History at Mississippi University for Women. Her book, Big Sister, Feminism, Conservatism, and Conspiracy in the Heartland, published by the University of Illinois Press, is our topic today. The author examines how 1970s right-wing women activists in the state of Indiana combined earlier political conspiracy theories, Cold War anti-communism, and anti-ERA sentiments to cast feminism as a threat to American democracy, free enterprise, and the family. Conservative women groups in the Midwest, such as Minute Women and Pro-America, rallied against the Equal Rights Amendment at a critical moment for feminism in the state. The strategies of the ERA Coordinating Committee, a coalition of 12 liberal organizations, was of low-key bipartisan lobbying of legislators that marginalized radical feminists. The soft-sale approach of Hoosier feminists threatened to kill ERA as it faced militant right-wing opposition. Kimker examines the motivations and organizational strategies of right-wing women and the problems feminists encountered in promoting ERA as a matter of simple justice and failing to directly counter the conservative critiques. Big Sister is a study of both conservative strategies that led to the rightward move of the Republican Party in the 1980s and the failings of feminists in delaying the ultimate passage of the ERA in Indiana, offering lessons for activists today. Here is my conversation with Erin M. Kimker. Let me introduce you to the author, Erin Kimker. Erin, how are you?
I am very well. How are you?
Welcome to the show, and thank you for sharing your thoughts with our audience. Before we get into the book, I want you to tell us why this book. You know, tell us about your background and why you came to write this book.
This was not the book I ever intended to write. I'm sure a lot of authors tell you that. This book had many stops and starts, but initially I wanted to write a book about feminism in the Midwest, and specifically Indiana, because that's where I found myself. I am a Midwesterner. I'm from Missouri. And so that question of what did feminism in the Midwest and not on one of the coasts, you know, what exactly did that look like? And how were these communities affected by feminism? I believed that they were. I had a sense that they were, but there wasn't a whole lot out there on it. And so I was very curious about that question. So initially, it was going to be a book about feminism. And when I got into the archives, what just kept coming up was the response to feminism. There were glimpses of it in the archives. Now had papers at the Indiana Historical Society and other women's groups, feminist groups supportive of the ERA, but there weren't that many collections specifically on anti-ERA women. But they showed up in these collections of women who supported the ERA. And so I kept getting glimpses of the anti-feminist argument, the anti-ERA argument, and it became very difficult in my mind to separate the history of feminism from the history of anti-feminism. And so I wrote the dissertation with a little bit of both sprinkled in and really struggled with what the book might be. So then I thought, well, I'll just tell the story of the anti-feminists because their story was compelling too. So the diss was about the feminists, and I'll now do a book about the other side. And I did for years thinking that that was going to be the book. But then, you know, in the last couple of years, it just became clearer to me that I needed to be able to talk about both and how they were responding to one another in real time. And so even though it was very hard conceptually to figure out how to do that, since we're talking about such different worldviews and such different politics, you know, I had some books on hand, like Susan Goodyear's No Votes for Women and others that looked at anti-feminists and feminists, you know, in a single book. And so that became then my goal, was to write a book that looked at both sides and tried to understand both sides, and then tried to explain ultimately the one to the other.
Now you situate your whole history in particularly not only the Midwest, but the state of Indiana.
Yes.
And we have to start with, and you start with, the culture of the Midwest.
Yeah.
What is it mean to be a Midwesterner? What does it mean to be a Hoosier?
Yeah.
You know that. And what is the social cultural context, yeah, in which these battles are going to be taken up?
Yeah, that became very important because it was clear that both sides were gauging the political and climate that they found themselves in. So then it became very important to understand what their perceptions of that political climate might be. How did they understand how their politics might play out in such a climate? Because they were crafting an argument for a specific place and time. And that was very clear in the ERA and the struggle to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. So it became important to me to understand then the political climate of the state, and really over throughout the 20th century, I mean. And that turns out is a pretty difficult thing because right now I'm at Mississippi University for Women. And, you know, the history of the South and the South as a region has a very strong identity. It has a very strong sense of itself culturally, historically. But that is not true of the Midwest. And so you get Midwestern scholars who are still trying to figure out, I think, you know, one historian called it, you know, it's a mushy place. Nobody even agrees really where it is on a map, much less, you know, sort of like cultural values that are shared by Midwesterners. But what I argue in the book, and what I do think is relevant for the women that I studied, is that there does seem to be an agreement among Midwesterners and among people in the 20th century that you need to be nice. You need to be polite. Radical politics are to be avoided, that there is a certain sense of community and an obligation that binds people together, and disrupting that is a huge social problem. And so there is an aversion to radical politics or conflict. And Richard Pierce talked about this in his book too, Polite Protest, which is what he called it, looking at the civil rights movement in Indianapolis. And other scholars have tried to find different ways of talking about it. James Madison? I think his book on Indiana, you know, he's talking about that Indiana believes in evolutionary, not revolutionary change. And so it seems that people are hinting at the same ideas. And I thought that was important to note in setting up the context of Indiana.
I think it's really interesting. And because in that environment of niceness, okay, mm-hmm, you've got this galvanizing moment against the ERA by right-wing women who it doesn't seem to me like they're particularly concerned about being nice.
Yes.
We're talking about radical politics. You're talking about maybe radical politics on the left.
Yes.
But it seems like there's a lot of room for radical politics on the right.
That is exactly right. And I do think that still fits in that trend, because the conservative women would say they are the upholders of tradition and gender and the notion of gender difference. So in that way, they are kind of prioritizing and celebrating the status quo. And so in that sense, they're not like encumbered with the same element of niceness. It's the feminists who want change. It's the feminists who are challenging our way of life. If your way of life is built on these heteronormative, you know, gender assumptions about men and women. And so for them, they almost have a freer hand. They aren't constrained in the same way. They have to defend what they see as radical attacks on this way of life, and on this notion that women and men are very different, that difference is ordained by God. And that difference should be maintained in the social structure of the United States. And so, yeah, they don't seem, and they are not bound by the same rules of politeness. Whereas I think the feminists understood that they were introducing change. Now they would say it was, you know, moderate reform change. They were very careful to try to paint themselves as non-radicals, right? This was a matter of, this was their quote, simple justice. And so they do seem to be much more conscious of being labeled radical, and to almost universally agree that that would be bad.
Well, it's interesting because it sounds, you know, the right wing women sound like Palin and her mama bear, you know, idea.
Yes.
You know, women, the mama bear defending, you know, the cubs and, you know, protecting them and willing to do anything to do it. So yeah. It's kind of, it's really interesting, but it's really pretty radical. And it does,
yes.
I think, overstep
yes.
the bounds of niceness. Now, the other thing I want to ask you about is you build your argument. And you spent quite a bit of time throughout the book in different places talking about the history of conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
And what they were, there's a long history of conspiracy theories.
Yes.
And it even goes back, you talk about it going back even to the New Republic. And why have these, what are these theories?
Yeah.
Why have they been appealing?
Yeah.
And how did feminism get connected to his conspiracy theories?
See, this was the most interesting thing, and it took me the longest, really, to suss out and understand. Because initially, when I saw these ideas, I have to be honest, I didn't know what to do with them. I didn't even know how to explain them because they seemed, to my mind, so far-fetched. You know, like you're reading about, you know, something like the Equal Rights Amendment, but then in opposing the Equal Rights Amendment, you're reading about people who are calling feminists traitors and, you know, talking about planners and this conspiracy of world government. And it made no sense to me at all. And it made no sense to the feminist women of the 1970s. They could not understand what was going on. They could not understand the vehemence of the attack that their opponents were putting up. And that took a lot longer. It took, and like you said, it takes a lot more explanation because it's not really well understood. So I think now after the 2016 election, maybe we're all more aware of just how common conspiracy belief is in the United States. But as I was writing this book, you know, that had not yet really burst onto the national consciousness, like, you know, that so many Americans really, you know, used conspiracy belief to explain the world around them. But in researching this book, what was clear is that conspiracy belief was really quite important to understanding conservative women's response to feminism, specifically what I call in the book and what others have called the New World conspiracy, or what I call in the book One Worldism. At least since World War II, but it has roots really in the Illuminati and other kinds of conspiracies of the earlier 20th century and even going back, like you said, to the founding of the country. There is this fear of centralized power in the United States, and it has European roots. And whether that centralized power is being created by the Illuminati or Jews, because a lot of this smacks with anti-Semitism and is you know, hews closely to those anti-Semitic arguments that were so popular leading up to World War II, that there is this cabal of elites in the world who are paving the way for one worldism or world government. And whether that's through the United Nations or through some other form, and that this world government will supersede the United States, and it will mean the elimination of national sovereignty, and we will all become global citizens, or even worse, like clogs in a cogs in a global government, and not even citizens, because it wouldn't be representative in any form. And so that fear, once you start really trying to dig in and understand it, is common in the United States. And then it is increasing over the course of the 20th century. As the federal government grows, it seems so does this fear that the federal government could and would cede control to a world government. And Catherine Olmsted is talking about that when she says, like, it used to be people feared attacks on the federal government, but by the late 20th century, it's people fearing that the federal government is the perpetrator of this sort of like centralized power conspiracy.
So, yeah, it's sort of like I'm thinking about when conspiracy theories recently, you know, we have 9/11 conspiracy theories, and we also have the deep state, which was more recent.
Absolutely.
That there is this covert government underneath the legitimate government that's elected. There's another government that's operating that's actually in charge of everything.
Yes.
Okay, so in this idea of the conspiracies, and also tied to that, of course, is the anti-communism. And and it seems like what the connection is that communism and this one world government is going to lead to the erasure of gender differences, motherhood, family. Yes. The children will be raised in, you know, in these communal daycares. They'll be taken away from you.
Yes.
And you know, the home will no longer be sacred because everything's going to be taken over by a social, you know, communal model of everything.
Planning, like social planners will not become responsible. That's exactly right. Like the fears of one world government are just sort of like layered on to almost the communist threats. And so you just kind of see those fears blended. But what that means is that those communist fears now have a new life, right? Like communism, just because the threat of communism is like lessens over the course of the 20th century and people fear that less, those older threats that it was always laid on top of, like that idea of a world government in which, you know, the personal and local and even like national sovereignty would be lost. And this idea of unisex treatment that feminists were pushing, that's the conservative women's understanding of it, or that's their language for it, unisex treatment, that men and women's roles will not be different. To them, that smacked of the same kind of homogenization that would be happening in a world government. Also, they're like focus on interracial politics, that somehow there would be an interracial, not gender binary future without national sovereignty, without borders, without a grounding in the Christian, Judeo-Christian tradition. All of these things to them sort of blended together these threats. And so feminism replaced almost communism as the leaders of this the one world government movement.
Well, it's really interesting that they have such faith in the ability of one world people to get together enough to get this done.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, you know, it's like, especially if they're doing it in secret, because, you know, you can't keep a secret anywhere in the United States today. You
yes.
know, if there is like a deep state, we would know about it, like, because people would be spilling the beans all over the place.
And I mean, you know, that's one of the things that I think you see in right-wing women's conversations. You know, I never could really understand or get at how many conservative women, how many people within like the anti-ERA umbrella or tent really push these ideas. Certainly some women, I think like Joan Gubbins, are willing to use these ideas because they speak to a common fear. It was unclear to me always how much she believed in them herself. But politically they're quite useful because it connects, you know, it connects what's happening today with a longer history. It creates a clear sense of good and bad, right and wrong. And it's a worldview that is not that new. I think that's one of the most remarkable things is just how long lasting some of these ideas are. You know what I mean? So it's like anything that happens, it's not really that new. You've got a framework for understanding this.
Right. You can just put it all in the same bucket.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all stemming from the same impulse. And for a lot of these conservative women who are also evangelical, that impulse was Satan. Like literally, this is the Antichrist at work. And I think that's also, I mean, a huge part of why they respond with such vitriol to feminism.
Okay, so let me ask you a question about these women themselves. What is their social economic position?
Mm-hmm.
Are these relatively affluent, or are they more middle class or upper middle class? Are there working women, working class women?
Right.
In this?
It's, I wish I had better demographic information. There was, you know, there's some good national demographic studies on anti-ERA women. But I think, you know, largely middle class, not all, but many were, stay-at-home wives. But certainly not all. They were not all mothers. They were not all married. Evelyn Pishke is a really good example of that. She was a single woman. She supported herself as a lawyer. A lot of these women are college educated. Most of the women that I found information on, and certainly the women I interviewed, were college educated women. So I think most historians would tell you they're not socially isolated. Right. So they're not, it's not that they lack understanding or education about the world. In many ways, they're quite politically savvy. They have good information about the political process and about how it works. And I think that a lot of their literature reveals that too, that they understand how to connect to their legislators. They understand the process that is necessary. They just have a very different worldview. Than the left.
What about Black women? I think that you had one woman in your book who was an African American.
There are at least two women that are anti-ERA delegates to the National International Women's Year celebration in Houston that were African American conservative women opposing the ERA. Okay. So there were at least two from Indiana there. I don't have any information written in their hand, and could not get any contact information because you know, a lot of time has passed and people didn't have it anymore. So I wasn't able to orally interview those women. I'm very curious to know more about them.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, and I'm just kind of wondering if there's a racial component in there in terms of, you know, the besieged African American family and how they particularly have a vested interest, of course, in supporting family structures.
Right.
That the, you know, it's yes. There's a real you know, political, social, and historical segment. I think that would make a very interesting book all by itself.
Oh, I do too. Oh, yes. And there is, you know, there's reference in the, I make reference to one historian's look at one of the most important speakers. She was a Black woman who went on to become a speaker in the John Birch Society and in the John Birch Society network. And so she's got a little bit more of a written record there. But yeah, this fascinating look at how, in some cases, Black women supported the conservative arguments of the time, and that they also felt very deeply invested in this notion of gender difference, in the biblical sanction of gender difference, and in its preservation.
And the family.
Yeah, very much the family, and believe that the family structure is really built on that preservation of gender difference.
So let me ask you about these right wing, the organization, the chapter that you had on their organization, how they organized.
Yeah,
you know, the their activism, the things they did, the phone banks and bookstores, and
yeah,
I just thought amazing amount of energy, strategy.
Yeah.
Thought.
That's what I mean. Really politically savvy and quite motivated. Like, you know, that's a remarkable commitment that these women made. Yes.
So can you talk a little bit about those, the tools and, you know, how the tools that they used and how they got themselves organized? Because it didn't seem, there were quite a few organizations involved, like the Minute Women or and Pro-America and but it seemed the most effective things were at the very grassroots housewife level.
It was, yes. You know, and so Minute Women had pioneered this idea that you could dispense with meetings if you could have effective telephone networks. And so, you know, they organized for action, a lot of protest action, but they never publicly admitted to an organized response. You saw that kind of in that chapter, that they never admit that there is a planning and organization to their strategy because they believed it would be more effective if it was seen as like independent women rising up calling their legislator or, you know,
organic.
Yeah, that it was somehow more effective as a political protest if their group never acknowledged that it had actually acted. And so they used the telephone for this because it was a very effective means. Women could access it from their homes. They could stay in contact with one another in that way, but they could also use it as a protest. So when something like the Indiana Civil Liberties Union was trying to get going, Minute Women called around and tried to make sure that no public space in the city would be open to them. And, you know, they could do that from their own home.
It's sort of like guerrilla warfare.
Yeah. I mean, in many ways, you know, it's really remarkable. The dedication that it took, but also just, you know, the vehemence of the response, right? Like to deny them meeting space. And, you know, they went on to acknowledge, yes, they absolutely thought that the Indiana Civil Liberties Union was a communist organization and protected communists. So they would use the telephone like that. They would use the telephone also, and you saw that Let Freedom Ring, where they would robocall. They robocalled people with specific messages and then directed them to their bookstore if they liked the message.
And they did a lot of research, too. I mean, deep research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Into the opposition.
Uh-huh.
Who they were encountering, who they were, how they were connected, who they knew, what they supported, you know, they did a lot of research. I think that was really interesting. It wasn't just action. It was really informed action. It was informed by backed up by a lot of research.
Yes. I mean, they read the congressional record. They read what their, you know, legislators are saying in the state house, but also in Congress. They comb through the National Education Association newsletters because they believe the National Association of National Educators Association is in league with One World, promoting that sort of like national health initiatives, promote this sort of global mindedness. So they're constantly on alert and researching these groups and their publications to track what they see as this conspiracy.
Well, what's really interesting about these women, too, was the fact that they became really unacknowledged leaders within the right.
Yeah.
They were not given within their own movement the credit or the acknowledgement or the platforms. Yeah. Because when we think about the right today, we see a parade of men.
Yeah.
Except for Phyllis Schlafly.
That's right.
You know, these women were not given the credit they were due. And one example that you give is the example of the Joan Birch Society and how it started.
Yeah.
And how women were important, but they were never really recognized as critical.
No. And I mean, Marguerite Dice, who is the regional leader of the Minute Women, and she runs the Indianapolis branch of the Minute Women, you know, she's the woman who opens her home and encourages Robert Welch to literally use her home to begin the John Birch Society. And he never acknowledges her politics, which he had to be aware of, who she was and the extensive work she had done, anti-communist work she had done in the state of Indiana and nationally, the Minute Women. But you never see reference to that in the John Birch Society, in the Blue Book, the founding really document of the John Birch Society. And even then after, really, it's only like Indianapolis Magazine. It's only really sort of like Indianapolis folks who are really aware that it was, you know, that the John Birch Society was born in Indianapolis for a reason, and that reason was Marguerite Dice. So, yeah, I think their argument in many ways acted to obscure their politics.
So is it some more like they wanted the reason they were willing to allow, you know, they didn't protest that was because the whole idea that men should be the ones in the public sphere, the men should lead the public arena, and they saw themselves as, we're just kind of backup forces.
That's right.
And we're home-based.
Yes.
We're not based in the public. We're based in the home.
Yes. I think their separate spheres argument very much supported that erasure from the leadership and from the image of the leadership. And then, you know, I I think there was ambivalence about that, although you don't really hear much of that in their public statements. But I do think that many of the women I interviewed, or some of the women I interviewed, did want leadership positions. They did want to take credit for what they had done. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
That was an ambivalence for them. And it's, you know, it's an ambivalence for Phyllis Schlafly, right? Like, her argument is that she is going into the public sphere to battle women so that other women can stay at home. But obviously it's taking her out of sphere, right? You know? And she thinks that's a worthwhile thing to do for her. She's willing to make that sacrifice. But I think one woman that I interviewed told me, like, where we really went wrong was in our response to working women. And I think that for many conservative women, you know, that ambivalence about always being in a supportive role and never taking the lead, that was a hard one. And they kind of see now maybe that the tide has turned against that. Because I don't think a whole lot has changed about their politics, but encouraging other women to become leaders, I think that is something that even the conservative women would get on board with.
Right, because it seems like there were other trends when this right-wing ideology is really rising, that there were other trends that were happening that were kind of facilitating. First was the loss of confidence in the federal government.
Yes.
And second was that there were more women going into the workplace.
Yes.
Mothers.
Yes. Yes.
In the workplace.
Yes.
More childcare.
Yes.
And that kind of those two trends would kind of nosedive with the rise of the right here.
Yes.
Okay. Let me ask you about, let's talk about the Hoosier feminism.
Yes.
The interesting part to me was the bipartisan nature of this nice
yes.
feminism.
Yes. Yes.
Let's talk about that.
Well, I mean, you know, when I talk to my students today, they don't understand that feminism was a bipartisan issue because it's become such a politically polarized issue. But no, in the 1970s, you know, absolutely, there were Republican feminists. And I point out that, you know, Richard Lugar was heading up the Men for the ERA. The Republican mayor of Indianapolis at the time, who would go on to become the Republican senator from Indiana. So there was Republican support for the ERA. And so part of the story of what is happening as these battles are going on is how these conservative women pull the Republican Party right. And it is through issues like the ERA in IWI, International Women's Year, and just as larger issues of feminism that they are pulling the Republican Party further right along. And so when we pick up this story, like in 1972, when Congress, you know, passes the ERA, Republican women in Indiana absolutely support the ERA, and they create the coalitions with Democratic women to get the ERA passed at the state level. But like you said, they make these calculations. And so one of the calculations is that, you know, it could be a hard sell for in a red state, a conservative with a conservative political climate. So let's make feminism nice. Let's keep it to a matter of, quote, simple justice. And as one woman says, let's create a mom and apple pie image of feminism. And basically, you know, try to undercut the conservative women's arguments that they represent motherhood by saying, no, we're wives and mothers too. So,
right. So yeah, I think that's really interesting because that flavor of feminism is still very much alive today.
Mm-hmm.
The many, many women who are politically conservative, who are in the professions, who have
yes.
big power careers.
Yes.
Okay. Will tell you that they are not feminist.
Right.
But they're living off the legacy of what feminism has accomplished for women.
Okay? Yes. And they might split the difference and say something like they believe in women's equality.
Right.
Like they believe in women's equality. They just don't believe in feminism. And part of that is, you know, I always ask a follow up. Well, what does feminism mean to you? You know, like I'm not sure
right.
that, but yes, a lot of these women, and at this point in time, feminism isn't loaded with with any negativity. So a lot of these Republican women are even self-identifying as feminists. They're not even saying like, no, we're not trying to be part. They're part of the feminist movement. They join now. they are in the feminist, you know, they are in feminist circles as Republican women. But it becomes increasingly difficult for Republican women over the course of the decade to maintain party loyalty and maintain loyalty to feminist organizations and feminist causes, because their party is increasingly, like I said, pulling right because of the anti-feminist response to the ERA and feminist issues. So for example, like, you know, you had a lot of Republican support in Indiana, but as conservatives ramp up their argument, they're losing state legislators to the anti-ERA side. And that leaves the coalition with this decision to make. Do we cut the Republicans out and just say, forget it, we're just going to try to get Democrats elected, basically, as a way to get the ERA in the state, which, of course, would leave the Republican women in a bad spot, right? Because it's clear that the ERA supporters are turning against the Republican Party, and their place then in a pro-ERA organization would be pretty questionable.
And that's when you come up with, that's when you hear statements rumbling through the decades, I didn't leave feminism, feminism left me.
Yeah.
You know, that. So let me ask you about the this pro-ERA coalition, feminist coalition. At 12 liberal organizations that brought it together, but there was a lot of division, and there was a strategic decision to sort of sideline radical women, the more radical feminists, because they just did not look good in the nice Midwest. Talk about that?
That was, you know, and that seemed to be the political calculation that some within HERA, the Hoosiers for the Equal Rights Amendment, which is that umbrella group that sort of brought together all the feminist and pro-ERA voices in the state, that seems to be the political calculation that they made. That, and that was another fascinating thing to me, is to learn that, you know, there were what we might call liberationists. There were, or what some historians have called radical feminists in the state. Before the ERA, there were feminist collectives in the state. Indianapolis had a women's liberation group. Bloomington had a women's liberation group. They were talking about issues of sexuality, about race. They were holding LGBTQ proms in Bloomington in 1970 as part of the feminist movement. You know, it was it seemed to be a very diverse movement in the late 60s and early 70s. But then it's ironic, isn't it? Like the introduction of the ERA and trying to accomplish state ratification required them to create an agreed upon understanding of what feminism was, because they were going to have to explain it to everybody in the state to get that ERA passed. And at that moment, the diversity that was the feminist movement was kind of ignored, but denied even more than ignored. And this, what they called the low key, we're going to low key the image of a feminist. And what that meant is that they were asking the radicals not to engage in street protest, for example. They were, you know, now had been involved and they were calling radio stations with sexist disc jockeys and trying to get them removed from the air. They were having abortion rights rallies. All of those kinds of activities would be out while they tried to get the ERA passed through the state house, which they hoped in 1972 would be quick, but it turned out to take a lot longer. And so that low-key strategy had some consequences.
One thing that struck me was it seemed like the feminists did not understand their opponents at all.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Right. And I mean, it seems like they had no strategy. They had a strategy for affecting the legislature to pass them, but they had no strategy for responding to the charges that were being made by these right-wing women.
Yeah.
They didn't address things that they could have addressed, like, oh, but you also work outside the home.
Right.
We're helping you. Or they could point it out how feminism had helped mothers. They could have pointed out, they could have made appeals to women in the past, you know, the women who vote for the worked for the suffrage movement. They didn't seem to know how to respond to this underground guerrilla political campaign they were
coming
up against.
They did try to make connections, and they did make connections between first and second wave feminists, or, you know, the suffrage movement and what they were doing. But so did the conservatives. They trotted out a suffragist at the state house. So, you know, they were contesting that, you know, they were both contesting, you know, for that connection. I think you're largely right. They did not understand these conservative women. And part of that is that, you know, like I said, there were different worldviews really developing in America in the post-war era after World War II. And, you know, these things just seem to really kind of like explode, it seemed to me, in the late 1960s, 1970s. And for feminist women, they just couldn't understand this label of traitor. Why were they, why, you know, what was that about? Why were they being called, especially, you know, because there was a religious coalition for the ERA, this charge that they were satanic, that they were in league with the devil. They didn't know what else to believe, but that these people were, you know, lying, or, you know what I mean? Like that they couldn't believe that. And then they met them and they realized they did believe it. And that bewildered them even more oftentimes when the two would come face to face and they would meet the opposition, and the opposition seemed to actually believe what they were saying. And that was even more astounding. And you saw that, like, in Molly Rucker's letter, like it was really hard for feminist women. They personally felt very much attacked by the response they got. It was very traumatic in many ways.
Now, on top of that, this is a national, this is a domestic feminist movement and push for the ERA, you know, was fueled by international things that were happening, like the International Women's Year, yeah, and the UN, which, yeah, world government. Okay.
Yes. That's exactly right.
So it seems to me like the association of domestic feminists with these international women's rights organizations really didn't serve them very well domestically.
Well, it certainly, you know, clicked every box for the world government folks, you know, the one worlders, you know, to them, it cinches the deal, right? There is just no doubt. If it's a UN, if it's a UN sponsored event, it is part of this conspiracy. And even if you're not maybe part of the elite cabal, you're a dupe of the elite cabal, which is going to get you the same rough treatment. And so, yeah, when, you know, ERA is followed very quickly by International Women's Year, which, you know, the UN sponsored this sort of celebration of women's political and, well, just women's involvement around the world, a celebration of women and women's achievements. And the United States, you know, participated in that with this, you know, series of conferences happening within states and then state level, and then culminating in that Houston conference. But for conservatives, you know, this was just one more piece of evidence that the UN directives were being enacted within the United States, and further connected in their mind feminists with that conspiracy. So, yeah, that was not, I don't know what, you know, in the world Indiana feminists could have done about that connection, but certainly that connection was a strong reason that conservative women turned out to IWY like they did.
I mean, you've got conservative women going to these events, mm-hmm, to gather information or evidence.
Yeah.
To bring back and say, look what's happening at these, mm-hmm, events. Mm-hmm. Look, you know, how American sovereignty is being compromised. You know, how the vision for the family or for gender is, you know, is going against our traditions and principles. I thought that was, they were very smart to go.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
They could have said, we don't go, we don't have anything to, right, do with that. But they actually said, no, we're going to go. It's like they went into their minds, enemy territory.
Yes, that's exactly how they described it. Yes. Yes. That is exactly how they described it. That is how they saw themselves. You know, according to Evelyn Pischke, she was fasting before she went to Houston. That she was like preparing almost for like a spiritual battle.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that is exactly how they saw it. And again, to the feminists, it's absolutely foreign and inexplicable, these responses to their demands for, like I said, what they saw as social justice. So, yeah, it was for the conservative women, I think in many ways it was empowering for them. They come back from IWI, and you can see in the letters that they wrote and in the correspondence that they have that they feel like they are accomplishing something that, even though the national conference was very much opposed to their views, it's almost like they went, they gathered all that information, they brought it back to their states so that they could expose feminism for what it really was as they understood it. And in many ways, I think they were very successful at gaining the ear of Republican legislators and gaining the ear of the Republican Party, because, of course, the ERA was taken off the Republican platform in 1980. And you saw the new right really rise to power in the Republican Party, which these women are very much a part of.
So what was the fate of ERA in Indiana?
Well, I do want to point out, because I think I don't want the book to come across as in any way critical of the calculations of feminist women. They didn't understand their opponents, and it would have been very hard, I think, for them to have understood their opponents. We're only beginning to suss this all out, decades after the fact. And in the end, the feminists did accomplish ERA ratification at the state level. Indiana is the last state in the nation to ratify the ERA, and it did so after a very long fight. ERA is ratified in Indiana in 1977. So in that sense, their political calculations and strategies worked. Ultimately, they got it. However, the ERA nationally fell short. It needed, 3/4 of the states to ratify, and it didn't get them.
And also, they created fuel in right-wing women to bring the conservative movement to prominence in the 1980s.
Yes. There's that great quote in the book where I think it's Frances Dodson Rome says, we inadvertently provided the platform for, the opposition. In creating these women's events and creating what they thought were going to be these celebrations of sort of like the feminist perspective and women's participation in the society, they created the space and the platforms in which conservative women launched their political movement. And so for them, it was bitter. It was very bitter.
You talk about the role of these women in the national conservatist movement, conservative movement within the Republican Party.
Yeah.
And Indiana is probably just one state and one example of probably multiple examples from other states where the same sort of pattern probably emerged. Do you have any insight into that?
I don't know other states. I know other state studies are certainly underway and being done, but it certainly looks like, for example, Beulah Cohenour is an example of this. She came up through these anti-communist conservative women's groups and was very active in the push to stop ERA and IWI. And then she went on to win election in the city county council and served for a long time in Indianapolis on the city county council. And then Joan Gubbins is another example. She was actually a state senator in 1968 and continued to be a state senator into the 1970s and then went on to work, had a couple of positions within the Reagan administration. None of these women, I would describe all of these women as grassroots. You know what I mean? Like they didn't go on to, lofty positions of power by any means, but their activism certainly continued into the 1980s and the 1990s. And those are just two examples, but certainly there are others. So, yeah, I think for the conservative women, Catherine Nuku is another example, and she went on actually to have a career in broadcasting. She created her own talk show series in the Indianapolis area and did, political interviews for many, many years after being involved in these organizations. So they launched really careers based on these politics.
So where are they? Where are right wing? I can't even say it right now. Right wing women today. Where are they today? What's on their agenda? Is there still this one world thing government going on? Is conspiracy theories? What's going on?
I haven't interviewed any. I've interviewed them. I believe it was 2011 and 2012, and so I haven't talked to anybody, you know, since the 2016 election to find out. And I'm hoping to maybe touch base. You know, obviously, I'm dealing with an aging population on that front, and so I don't have any specific information about where their ideas are then, or where their ideas are now. At the time when I interviewed them, none of the women I interviewed really acknowledged or talked about conspiracy belief as being important to them. They kind, you know, Joan Gubbins especially just kind of said, oh, yeah, those ideas are around. Those ideas are always there. But I was really focused on this. So they were distancing, you know, Joan Gubbins specifically was, you know, distancing herself from those ideas. And yet when you read her at the time, you know, the arguments she was making, she was very much engaging in those beliefs. Now, because of the prominence of conspiracy theory and Donald Trump's, you know, own use of conspiracy theory during the election, and then certainly so much after, I'm not so sure if they would feel the same need to distance themselves from it. So I think it's possible that, you know, the women that I interviewed, but even more, you know, women in the right today might be more willing to talk about these beliefs. But that's all just, you know, conjecture on my part, because like I said, I haven't had a chance to get back in touch and find out what, if any, of their, you know, thoughts have changed.
So, Erin, what is the takeaway for the listener of this podcast or the reader of your book? What is the main thing that you want them to know?
I guess what I think the most important aspect of the book that I didn't get anywhere else was understanding just how much conspiracy belief affected feminist strategy and also affected what happened to feminism, the story of feminism. I think you have to understand the argument of the other side to understand the kind of strategies and accomplishments that feminism was able to create. So I would look at, and what I think is most important, is just understanding how much conspiracy belief really circumscribed the feminist movement. Yeah, something like that.
Thank you, Erin.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Lillian. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in Gender Studies. This is your host, Lillian Barger.